A commitment to rescuing struggling rural communities, an effort to find a new voting system for the state, and expanded medical marijuana laws are all headed for debate in the upcoming legislative session. We'll ask our panel about those issues and more on this edition of Political Rewind. Glad to have all of you with us for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We got a lot to talk about, so let me introduce today's panel right away. We start with the AJC's lead political writer, Jim Galloway. You read him in the Wednesday and Friday newspaper. He also oversees the Political Insider blog, part of Politically Georgia, part of myajc.com. It's a lot to say, Jim.
Think of it as an onion.
Yeah, or a Russian doll. We don't want to talk Russians at this point.
Nick is listening.
Right across from you is your colleague, Greg Bluestein, who is the most prominent political reporter at the AJC, covered the entire governor's race, and you're already moving on to other races, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show. Hi, Greg.
How's it going? Glad to be here.
Good. Loretta Lepore is with us. She's a Republican strategist. She was Sonny Perdue's press secretary back when Sonny was governor of Georgia, and she was the co-chair of Carly Fiorina's Georgia campaign during the 2016 presidential race. Loretta, hi.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. And across from you, back for the first time, you haven't been here for quite a while, Representative Scott Holcomb, a Democrat. You represent Chambly, Doraville, Partagonet,
Brookhaven and unincorporated DeKalb.
Okay, basically, the district centered essentially in DeKalb County.
That's right.
All right. It's very nice to have a legislator on the show today because no sooner have the midterm elections come to an end than we turn our attention to exactly what's going to happen in the General Assembly, which starts the second Monday in January. We'll have a new governor in place. There will be more Democrats than there have been in the legislature, which should produce some interesting dynamics. And a lot is going to happen in this session. Plus, we're already going to begin to talk about the 2020 election, which really is coming up a lot more quickly than a lot of people realize. Okay, let's start with a legislative agenda. Both of you have had stories in the past week that give us a pretty good taste of what we can expect. Jim, you talked to Speaker Ralston, did an extended interview with him, and among other things, he's really committed to this, to the rural development program that he and his colleagues have been working on for some time.
Right. I thought it was very significant that they rolled that out actually a week ago, previous jumping ahead of Brian Kemp and the new governor's agenda. Obviously, the state senate is still getting itself organized with the new lieutenant governor Jeff Duncan. So they jumped out of the box and they set a fairly high bar on some really interesting issues. The broadband issue, of course, was one on new communications taxes, lower but broader. They would be hitting satellite TV and streaming services for the first time.
Because what they want to do is make up for the deficit of broadband in parts of rural Georgia.
Right.
The explanation being, without good internet service, there are so many things you cannot accomplish.
It's the key to health care. It's the key to education. And it's the key to economic development.
Yeah. So we've got that piece of it. And, Greg, you were out in Athens this past week when Brian Kemp made his first major speech of the session. He, too, talked about rural development. How much difference do you see? You read Galloway's piece, I'm sure. How much in sync are the House leaders and the governor on this issue right now?
They were simpatico when it came to rural development, those issues. What we didn't hear from Brian Kemp was any mention of any social cultural issues like Jim got to ask Speaker Ralston about. What was one of the more interesting takeaways from Jim's piece about Speaker Ralston was his serious concerns about religious liberty. Governor like Kemp did not make any mention of religious liberty. Every time he's asked about it, he goes back to saying that he would sign the 1993 version, not one word less, not one word more. But the question is whether or not we're going to see conservatives put any political capital behind that. And what we heard from interviews from Speaker Ralston, from Kemp's speech, and from Republican leaders up and down the ranks was essentially a focus on pocketbook issues, economy, rural development, And the like, and really a sort of no appetite for many social issues. We know that could probably change, yeah. But right now that's what they're talking about.
So for the time being, I do want to get to the social agenda, which certainly Brian Kemp emphasized during his campaign. But before we go there, Scott, let me bring you into this conversation. I mean, rural development has been something that you've seen over the course of the last really two sessions become a bigger and bigger matter in the House. Is there a bipartisan appetite for addressing the needs of rural Georgia right now?
I think that there is. I think I will say, though, that the base of Republican support in Georgia right now is rural, and so that's not an accident in terms of this focus. But I do think that there are opportunities for rural support or bipartisan rural support, and particularly on broadband and on healthcare expansion. I have been a very strong proponent of expanding Medicaid. If we have to do it as a waiver, that's fine, but I think that that's more the answer in terms of where we need to go. And if I was striking a deal, I would say anything on rural broadband has to be coupled with Medicaid expansion.
You know, Loretta,
that's interesting.
Go ahead.
No. I'm saying that's news. Pay attention to that.
Okay. Go ahead.
But I'd add too that Republicans might not need any Democratic support for that. We'll see. Yeah. But you know, as it stands right now, Republicans there has to be a majority vote for a Medicaid expansion. But they still have a majority of both chambers, so they might not need Republican support to get there. But look, you could see a grand compromise. I don't know.
I agree that they don't need our support, but I think that look at the facts. 90% of hospitals that have failed in rural areas in this country are in states that have not expanded Medicaid. The evidence is there. And one of the benefits of Georgia being a laggard here is we have seen what has worked and has not worked in other states. And I think the data is pretty compelling that this is the way to go. I firmly agree with the notion, however, that rural broadband is essential for both economic, health care, and educational opportunities in the rural areas. It's akin to modern highways. It is an infrastructure issue. And the bottom line is there is no free market solution, which is why the state government has to look at getting involved.
So, Loretta, Galloway caught me making the most fundamental mistake of somebody asking questions. I was thinking about my next question. While Holcomb was making news.
That's right.
And the question I was framing was one that, in fact, came out of a part of what he said a minute ago. The rural initiative that the House is so interested in right now does, you know, it's completely compatible with the way that Governor-elect Kemp ran his campaign. He focused on rural Georgia. So let me flip the equation on its head. If we understand the governor-elect is going to want to do something for rural Georgia, but how careful does he have to be as he moves forward that he's also doing something for the parts of the state that didn't vote for him?
Well, that's going to be very important this cycle. But rural Georgia, and I think the case that needs to be made that is not being made currently, is that taking care of some of these issues in rural Georgia also helps suburban and urban areas. Healthcare, for example, that's a universal issue across Georgia, and it needs to be spoken about that way. It's not just a rural issue. There is also concern within urban areas of this state and suburban. And so we need to make sure that that's a statewide message. The other thing, and I think waivers is probably the direction that they're going to do. I don't know about coupling this. I think we've heard from both the governor-elect and the speaker that waivers seems to be more appetite for that. We know when we left off the session last year, there was a bill that had gone through much work in both chambers around broadband, and in the very, very final minutes just didn't make it across the finish line. And I know that all of the parties have been working through this, you know, over the year, and so we're likely to see that come out real early in the session.
Jim, the speaker in your interview said to you, we don't want to rely on the federal government for health care, suggesting that he's not still going to support Medicaid expansion.
And there was no, in the Rural Development Council report, there was no mention of Medicaid expansion, mention of Medicaid waivers. The speaker kind of hinted that if it was going to be talked about, it was going to have to be an initiative out of Governor Kemp's office.
But go ahead, if I could. Sure.
The one thing that was in there that was very interesting was the House basically declared an all-out assault on the certificate of need process for hospitals across the state of Georgia, which is not necessarily a rural issue. In fact, one could argue that it's much more important to Metro Atlanta.
So the most simple explanation, I think it's safe to say, of a certificate of need is it. A hospital cannot simply go out and buy an MRI machine. It has to have clearance approval from the state before it does that. Presuming that there's got to be some 10,000-foot view of who's spending money on what equipment
Like. Nor can an ambulatory surgical center set up shop across from a hospital with an emergency room.
Okay, so why is that? It's interesting that Galloway says, Scott, this is it's part of the rural package, but he sees it as very important to the rest of the state as well.
Well, there's a lot of controversy over it, so it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But these issues, Loretta is right, is that these issues of healthcare do match, or the interests match across rural, suburban, and cities. Because the area that I represent, the hospitals in the area, they want Medicaid expansion too. The thing about the waiver is that actually can look exactly like Medicaid expansion. It's really just a political dodge to say that we're doing something different.
Yeah. Greg, you're nodding.
Yeah, I mean, look, a Medicaid waiver is the same thing in some sense as Medicaid expansion because it's more federal funding for the Medicaid program. The Kemp campaign has always said, we're not accepting Medicaid waivers, we're accepting Affordable Care Act waivers, which is a little bit different, to stabilize private insurance markets. But look, on the CON issue, the Certificate of Need, I quizzed dozens of lawmakers about what they think the sleeper issue of the year is going to be, because there's always something that creeps up on us. And many of them said they think CON was going to be a knockout, drag-down fight.
CON is always highly controversial.
Why?
It's a tough issue. Well, for some of the reasons that Jim mentioned, they're different. The controversy around CON in Metro is
different
than rural.
Certificate
of Need.
Go ahead.
Too commonly as CON.
Yep.
For obvious reasons. You know, I think in Metro area, it's about competition.
Right.
And you have many more hospitals in Metro Atlanta. You have more surgical centers, imaging centers. You know, all of these, what certificate need essentially is the community health department's ability to regulate healthcare. This is where the regulatory component comes in. CON approvals take forever, and they require their own campaigns, by and large, to get approved. And so what you find is you end up with different systems and hospital systems really competing, and this is mentioned in the rural healthcare, the report that came out from the legislature study group, that there may be some accommodation so that there can't be that kind of confrontational other entities contesting at the same level certain I know this is getting very complex, but for example, if one hospital wants an open heart surgery facility, hospital B cannot come out and wholeheartedly contest
that. So let me see if I can set this in the broadest terms and see if I've got it right. For rural areas of the state, Jim, you might want to ease regulations on certificate of need because they've already got a deficit of health care facilities, clinics, hospitals, the technology. On the other hand, in Metro Atlanta, where you've got Emory University Hospital expanding like crazy, Piedmont Hospital expanding like crazy, in that kind of setting, the certificate of need, as Loretta was describing it, plays a different role.
Right. In Metro Atlanta and places like it, what you have is you have a health insurance or a medical industry driven by health insurance. By health insurance premiums, there's lots of money, and the nonprofit organizations and the for-profit organizations are chasing after it. In rural Georgia, that cash is not there.
Yeah.
So it's a different dynamic.
I love the fact that you're telling us this is a sleeper issue that we're all going to end up watching, even though we're not even thinking about it, except on this show today. It wasn't on my list of things to talk about.
Exactly. No, and don't forget, too, there are about 24 or so rural hospitals have either closed or in financial distress. And the other pillar of Kemp's healthcare policy is expanding that rural healthcare tax credit that Jeff Duncan was actually the author of in the state house. Now he's the most, what we're assuming, the most powerful, one of the most powerful people in the Republican-controlled Senate. And so he's going to make that a priority as well.
Scott, another issue that you are certainly going to be asked to take up is really multifaceted. You're going to look at election issues. Certainly, you're going to be asked to look at recommendations that come out of what was Brian Kemp's commission studying new voting machines. But beyond that, I'm assuming you are also going to be looking at legislation that may revamp how we do perform different kinds of votes. Mary Margaret Oliver was on the show on Wednesday. She wants to look at things like exact match. How do we deliver provisional ballots, absentee ballots? So what we do and how we vote is going to be a big issue this session, too. Yes,
it will be. I'm not terribly optimistic that we're going to get much accomplished, but I think that it is going to be a big issue in terms of the state's voting machines. I think that there is pretty broad support that those need to be updated. It's fairly well known that we use machines from 2002 that operate on a Microsoft 2000 operating system that hasn't even been updated since 2010. It's a joke. And my position is we need hand-marked paper ballots with optical scanners. That's the position of most experts that have looked at this. There seems to be a big push to cater to the vendors. Vendors want to spend or have the state spend about $100 million. I keep saying watch the money because I'm sure that they're making massive campaign contributions as we head into the session. So we need to have a discussion about that. We need reform on all those issues, voter match, purging, et cetera. Ideally, these should be done in a bipartisan way and ultimately unanimously be great. But again, I'm not optimistic that that's going to happen.
You know, it's interesting, Loretta, because we're going you'd think getting a new voting machine in place for the state could be a relatively easy matter. Except what you've got now is Scott Hocum, like a lot of Democrats, particularly, there may be some Republicans who are there as well, who's saying, let's have hand-marked ballots. Let's fill in the bubble, whatever. Because that's the way to really avoid hacking of any sort. Feed them into an optical scanner. But Brad Raffensperger will become Secretary of State, and he's made it clear he wants another touchscreen machine. He wants a paper trail. But interestingly enough, on something you would think is as simple as that, we look like we're going to have some confrontations.
Well, that's what it's come down to. I mean, the commission this past week has looked at, do you have it, as Scott suggested, do people mark the ballot before it goes to the machine, or does it go to the machine and then print out the paper ballot in which the voter would then verify their vote was cast correctly and then drop it into a bucket? That's where we are now in terms of this debate on which type of machine we're going to move forward with. I thought one of the interesting things to come out of the commission discussion was instead of purchasing the new machines is to lease them. And with technology advancing at such a rapid speed, that seemed a viable option, particularly because there would need to be such a significant appropriation to update those machines, which are the oldest in the nation, I believe, almost at this point.
Yeah.
That was one of the recommendations from Winky Lee, the Georgia Tech cybersecurity expert, who basically said, we're going to have this entire debate again in a decade or so if you don't lease the machines, and it's cheaper, at least up front, not to purchase them and spend the $30 to $150. There's a wide range of cost estimates. And I think that will be part of the debate. And really, there is a willingness from Republicans I've talked to address a broader changes to the system, too, that go beyond these voting machines as well, to look at the uneven practice of counting absentee and provisional ballots, maybe even to look at some of the voter cancellation purge issues as well, too. So this could be, we didn't mention this as a sleeper issue because this could be the signature issue of next year's session.
Well, here's what, but I'll tell you, at the biennial meeting in Athens this week, I ran into Ed Reinders, who is the chairman of the House Governmental Affairs Committee, which is that's the body that will get a first look at all of these things, from voting machines to voting processes. And he declared that he was going to be probably the busiest man in the legislature.
I'll bet he will be. Okay, so is this an opportunity for Governor-elect Kemp? There was so much controversy, and we're going to talk about one item that a story that broke in the AJC over this weekend that is pretty interesting, but there's so much controversy about the way the election was run. Everything from the purge of voters, all the other things that we read about, accusations of voter suppression. You were out there in Athens when Brian Kemp gave his first major speech, and he sounded much more, you tell us, moderate. He was moderate in his tone. He moderated his message. Would this be an opportunity for him to, in fact, bring Democrats and Republicans together and signal he really is willing to work with both sides to say, yeah, I am interested in looking at some election reform measures?
Sure, it certainly would be. I mean, it's something that he said in an interview with us a couple weeks ago that he's open to as well. The contours of that are still undefined.
Yeah.
But what he does is he pits it as not concerns from Democrats, but as concerns from local elections officials who did struggle with how to count provisional ballots, long lines, you know, unequal standards for how many voting machines should be at each site. Right. I mean, if there are state standards for that, it's a lot harder for Democrats to claim voter suppression if each voting precinct has to have a certain amount of voting machines.
But you do have an ideological divide here, and the language that Republicans and Democrats use. Republicans are always talking about voter security, and of course, Democrats are always talking about ballot access.
Right.
And the question is, can those two concerns coexist?
Scott, how much of an appetite is there among the people in your caucus, the Democrats in the House, to bury the hatchet and work in a collegial way with Governor Kemp? How much anger is left in the aftermath of a very contentious election? What do you see as the future of how you work with the governor?
It's a question mark, I think, is the honest answer. I think that there is a lot of strained feelings still, and part of what we're looking at is to see which direction he goes in. I think the governor-elect has a very strong tendency to moderate whatever he's saying to whatever room he's in, and it adjusts pretty rapidly and easily. And so what are his core principles? What are his objectives? What is he going to push for as governor? And we don't know what that's going to be like. Is he going to take a very hard right stance? If so, that's not going to be an easy path. Or is he going to moderate more and really try to take steps that I think will move Georgia forward?
Loretta,
cooperation.
I'm sorry, Scott. We got to take a break in a minute. Before we do, you worked for a governor who came in after decades and decades and decades of Democratic control of the governor's mansion. That's Sonny right. Perdue shocked everyone by winning that election. And so there was a lot of bad feeling by the other party, the Democratic Party, about him. What do you do? Do you start bringing in the Scott Hocums for individual meetings with the governor, you know, sit him down in the governor's office? The governor says, tell me about what you want to do, Scott. Let me tell you what I want. How do you deal with that?
Well, it was a little different because you had a Republican governor and you still had two Democratic chambers.
Right.
Right. So he had to work with members of those chambers, and he had been a Democrat before, being a Republican and winning the governorship. And so, yes, you are working across party lines. One bill I can think of in particular was a Child Protection Act. We were the last state in the nation to have a Child Protection Act. And the governor reached across the line to the lieutenant governor at the time and said, who had been trying to get that bill passed for several years, and said, let's do this together. Let's get this done together.
We're going to see that kind of, do you think that's the sort of thing that a Kemp will do, given that he does have control of both chambers?
It's something that he can do. It's just a matter of, will he do
okay.
it? And by the way, Sonny started with a Republican Senate, because he was able to, between November and January, he was able to flip.
Oh, he flipped seats. He got people to flip parties. That's right.
So he started with a Republican Senate, even though we had a Democratic lieutenant governor.
Yeah. All right. We got to get to a break. I do want to talk about social issues a little bit when we come back, because that is certain, as it is every session, to be something we'll be talking about from January well into the end of March. We'll come right back. This is Political Rewind.
You've counted on GPB throughout 2018 to bring you insights into important issues and events, and you'll continue to rely on GPB in the new year. Your support makes all the programs that matter to you possible. As you support the organizations that are important to you during this season of giving, please include GPB. Make your tax-deductible year-end gift now at gpb.org or call 800-222-4788. From all of us at GPB, thanks and happy holidays.
And we're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Greg Bluestein, Loretta Laporte, Scott Hocum are with us. Greg, let me turn to you on this first. You pointed out at the very top of the show that in his speech to the legislators out in Athens, he didn't mention the social issues that he'd really highlighted in his campaign. So he did not talk about the religious liberty bill, although he did say at different points, yes, I support religious liberty if it's modeled after the federal law, which was passed by Bill Clinton, a Democratic president, and he didn't talk about his expanded gun carry proposals, which were also something he discussed on the campaign. How quickly are those things going to be bubbling up?
Well, the expanded gun already has, right? At least one lawmaker, a Republican lawmaker, has already introduced that bill. So what that means is these debates aren't going away. The big question is whether or not powerful Republicans like Governor-elect Kemp, like Speaker Ralston, like Jeff Duncan, and their chamber's leadership get behind them and put political capital there. And that's going to be the open question for Brian Kemp. Odds are, I mean, all the signals he's sending right now is that he's not going to put significant capital behind this. He's going to focus on rural. He's going to focus on his education plan to raise teacher pay and fund school security. That doesn't mean those issues are going away, and that doesn't mean he won't be pressured, let's say, in February or March to come right back to it and do something for the conservatives who made him the nominee.
But you've got specific lawmakers in the Capitol who are highly vulnerable to any debate over issues like that. You've got Jan Jones in North Fulton, Sharon Cooper in Cobb County. You have Renee Unnerman in Gwinnett. Yep.
All of whom are in districts that are moving more and more to the Democratic Party.
Exactly. And,
right.
and you do have 2020 coming up fast.
Well, but the Senate, Jim, we all know this. The Senate is the incubator for that kind of measure.
It has become that, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But so, yes, it could change given those dynamics you just described. On the other hand, in your conversation with Ralston, Speaker once again expressed skepticism about that kind of social measure.
The House lost 11 seats. And it's coming close up on the House's membership. 75 Democrats. That's very, very close to really stopping some significant issues.
You think?
Yeah, my take is I don't think that there's a lot of enthusiasm in the House. I don't think that this is something that's going to get a lot of traction. And part of me says, do it, because if you do it, you're going to lose 10 to 15 more seats in 2020.
I think that's a reality. I mean, I think to Jim's point, he's put out there some legislators that will be vulnerable. And what we've seen in this last cycle is that we lost several in Metro. In particular, all the people that you mentioned were female legislators.
Right, right.
And we lost already a handful of Republican female legislators in the metropolitan area. I don't think the Speaker wants to go down that route.
But the problem is that the House Republican caucus and the Senate Republican caucus are actually more conservative now, because the ones who lost in Metro Atlanta might be considered moderates.
Right.
Well,
several of them voted previously against RFRA.
Okay, so what are we saying here? Do we imagine that a bill like RFRA gains traction, but that the governor quietly says, we don't need this right now, folks, you know, goes to the Speaker and says, get out there on my behalf, block this thing. Ralston doesn't need the governor. He's already on his own fought this thing for a couple of years now. But where does Kemp stand in this kind of situation?
I don't know. I think to Greg's point, that's kind of the question as to how far. I mean, we do know that on his transition team, Virginia Galloway sits on his transition team. She's with the Faith
Christian
and Freedom Coalition.
Right.
And
so
she
Alan
serves
Fox.
on the policy committee, right? And Alan Fox obviously is on the transition team as well. And so, you know, that's kind of an open-ended question as to, you know, I think at biennial he was trying to set a tone of unity, specifically a tone of cooperation. He chose issues where Republicans and Democrats can find common ground, no matter what shade of conservative or liberal they may be, but where we know there has to be work in the state for Georgia to move forward. And I think that he's been conciliatory also in the past week in meeting with Mayor Bottoms and I know we're going to talk a little bit about a new corporate relocation. And so those are big things. So I think if you look at what he's said this past week, if that's an indicator of where we're going, I think that those social issues are going to take a back seat.
Yeah, just to clarify, Virginia Galloway, part of Faith and Freedom Coalition, which, of course, was founded by Ralph Reed. So very conservative organization that has very clear ideas about a social agenda that they'd like to establish. Scott?
Yeah, Bill, I'll add there that I think one One idea that the governor really should consider is that Georgia is one of five states that doesn't have a hate crimes bill. That would be well received in my caucus if he were to embrace support for that. We should also, I think, start looking at non-discrimination procedures and policies as well. So we will be looking very carefully to see how that moves forward. But if I were to make a prediction now, I don't think RFRA moves in 2019.
Yeah. And what Representative Holcomb's sort of talking about is what's ping-ponging along the Republican caucus, which is maybe, especially for conservatives who support religious liberty but also want to put the perennial debate behind them, sort of grand compromise where there's a civil rights 2.0 part of it. Yes, there's the 1993 version of RFRA, and there's also coupled together with hate crimes legislation and or the sexual orientation protections the Democrats have long wanted. If you package that in together, you still might not have the votes you want, but it could be seen as some sort of, and you asked Speaker Ralston about that, but he didn't really give you
No, he wanted to think about that one a little bit more.
Yeah. I can tell you he's probably already thinking about it, but he's not like quite ready to talk about it yet.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Scott makes the point that we don't have a hate crimes measure here. And despite the fact that it is 2019 and we think that we've become more progressive in many ways, the fact is that protections for on the basis of sexual orientation are still lacking in the state. We have no civil rights statute. That was, Loretta, of course, one of the things you can say about the federal RFRA is that it's accompanied by a civil rights law, which does, in fact, on one hand, it protects religious organizations that have strong feelings about, you know, whether they hire or not, don't hire certain people. But it also protects minority groups against discrimination. We have no such law in Georgia.
That's right. And in many other states. So when the case is often made about needing to push this forward and that other states have RFRA laws on the books that align with the federal statute, they also have
Civil rights
laws on the books. So that's one of the deficits that we clearly have in this debate.
And who are the Republicans most forcefully advocating? The suburban Republicans who are now mostly gone from the legislature.
Loretta mentioned it. We saw an example of city-state cooperation. You wrote about it, Greg, between Mayor Bottoms and Governor Deal over a very complicated land acquisition package, the Gulch. Essentially, the bottom line is Norfolk Southern, a Fortune 500 company, owns that land in the Gulch, right?
You got it. They own land in the Gulch. They said if that land could be sold to redevelop the Gulch into a $5 billion mini city in the heart of downtown Atlanta, then they would move their headquarters to Midtown Atlanta, bringing a $575 million new campus and about 850 jobs. That required an unprecedented level of cooperation from the governor's office and City Hall to work together on getting this Gulch package passed by the Atlanta City Council. And that required the governor and his top aide to wade into the heart of a city council debate in a way that we haven't seen really in the past.
And we weren't really, I don't think, Jim, because we asked about this at the time, gee, why is the governor getting so involved in the city council deliberations over the Gulch? Because we didn't really understand what the deal was.
Think of the image of Chris Riley in
the governor's chief of staff
in flip-flops going to lobby city council members on this issue. One thing, you know, Bill, you and I are old. When we first started working here in Atlanta, underground Atlanta was at its height.
Yeah.
You know, it was a section of Atlanta that had been kind of built over, right? And it became a fascinating night spot for a while. It's less so now. And now we have a development that's going to build a 40-foot ceiling over the Gulch, and create yet another but massively larger underground Atlanta.
Yeah, yeah.
Good point,
Scott. What do you think? Brian Kemp walked across the intersection. He crossed over from the state capitol to visit Keisha Lance Bottoms in her office at Atlanta City Hall. Good sign. Does it suggest to you that we're going to continue in your eyes to have some open lines of communication that suggest the chiefs head officers of both the city and the state can work together?
I think it is a very good start, and I certainly commend him for that. I will be critical when needed, but I will also say nice things when appropriate. And I think that that was a very, very solid gesture. But the fact is, the state needs the city of Atlanta. The metro region is 78% roughly of our state's GDP. So we need to have a successful capital region in terms of the economy. So I'd like to see more of that going forward.
But we should point out, Loretta, that partnership works both ways, because it was Kasim Reed's partnership with Nathan Deal that lent muscle to funding for the Savannah Harbor expansion. So the rest of the state gets some benefits out of this kind of partnership, too.
Well, right. And that alliance was important because we had a Democratic president at the time,
right.
Barack Obama. And so Kasim Reed, we had a lot more cachet walking in together, but not only depending on who's sitting in the White House, but when you look at federal agencies, they much prefer to provide funding to municipalities, to states, to projects where there is intergovernmental cooperation that is key to how they appropriate or grant funds. And so that relationship is critical to a lot of projects throughout the state. So not only the Savannah Port, but the Brunswick Port, for that matter.
The Mercedes-Benz headquarters was one.
The headquarters, but also to projects like the Atlanta Beltline, for example, which requires significant federal funding. Any kind of major transportation project, MARTA, whatever the ATL decides to put forward. So it's very important that we have state and local officials working together cooperatively, and that's seen publicly.
So, Jim, I'm also hearing in what Loretta's saying that this time around, it's Keisha Lance Bottoms, the mayor of Atlanta, who might need Brian Kemp to advocate for her in a Republican Washington.
Right. But to Loretta's point, that relationship could very well take a hairpin turn in 2020. We don't know.
Right.
And also, she'll need him in a Republican Gold Dome, because what is she probably most worried about? The other day, there was a study committee hearing at the Georgia Capitol about the state takeover of Atlanta's crown jewel, the Hartsfield-Jackson Airport.
And boy, that meeting, they sounded more determined than ever, Scott is nodding, to try to do something to take over the airport. Is that going to really bubble up and be something that you're going to have to deal with this session?
I think it will, and certainly there seems like a lot of enthusiasm for it in the Senate. I'm not sure the reception that it will receive in the House. I'm not a big fan of just changing structures just to change structures, and I have real skepticism in terms of what they're trying to do. But I think the people who are very committed to this are not going to let it go.
There may also be a game of three-dimensional chess going on here, in that Delta is has become a very outspoken corporate entity in Atlanta on certain issues, including religious liberty, and this is something. And right now, Delta is pretty much commands the Hartsfield. I mean, it's in the city, but the Delta pretty much controls that. And that if that control is threatened, well, that may be a message to Delta on other issues.
All right, I got to get to a break. Do you want to give them a last word?
Say, you talk about an ascendant corporate power under the Gold Dome. It's Delta. Not only did they get the tax break in the special session, but they also basically got the end of any effort to commercialize the West Georgia airport that they had long feared in Paulding County.
Nathan Deal did him a favor, turned it into an academy for training, right?
You got it.
All right. We got to get another break out of the way. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about a story that has appeared in the Atlanta Constitution in the last day or so that has to do with something that happened right before the midterm election. And we're also going to talk just a little bit. We're going to go back in time with Galloway and talk about his reminiscences of an early indication of Donald Trump not being so popular among certain people in the state. We'll get to that when we're back on Political Rewind.
I'm Corva Coleman. Politics dominated the headlines in 2018, but it was a big news year for a lot of other reasons, too, like the cave rescue in Thailand that captivated the world.
All of the kids and their soccer coach have made it out of the flooded cave in northern Thailand.
So much happened in 2018, and we were there for it all. Here's how to help us tackle 2019. Make a contribution now at gpb.org or 800-222-4788.
I'm Ira Plato. This week on Science Friday, we field a question from a curious second grader. about her unfortunate encounter with a caterpillar.
Is it okay if you guys can study about the ash caterpillar? Well, the thing is, I got stung. It itches a lot. Are there other caterpillars that sting?
It's All Things Caterpillar on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 on GPB.
On the weekend before the election, you will recall that a blockbuster report, a press release, was dropped on all of us in the media. The Secretary of State's office put out a news release saying that the state Democratic Party had attempted to breach the security of the state's voting system. It was, of course, a huge story at the time because, among other things, Brian Kemp was still Secretary of State, and questions were immediately raised as to whether this was a political ploy by the Republicans, by the Kemp campaign in the final hours before the election. Okay, so that happened then. In the month or so since then, any number of you out there who listen to this show and tweet us, post on Facebook Live to us, send me emails, have said, gee, whatever happened? Is there a story there or not? Or was it all simply an election campaign ploy? All right. So the AJC's Alan Judd, an investigative reporter, has been looking at this situation. And he published a lengthy takeout on this, Jim. Without going into the weeds on this, what I came away from on this was Judd suggests that we know that it was an independent party that wanted to test the security of Georgia's votes because there have been problems in the past. That individual found vulnerabilities and did, in fact, take them to the Democratic Party to say, here's something you ought to look at. What Judd's story essentially says is that if the Democrats had been the first to get the news out on this, the story could have been, once again, the Secretary of State's office is not protecting the security of your registration, whatever. Instead, they didn't do anything, and the Kemp folks had the opportunity to say Democrats were trying to tamper with the election.
Yeah, the way that the story got out was a little bit more complicated.
Right.
This fellow did contact Democrats. Democrats did send something to their attorneys and a few technical experts, including a lawyer who was representing defendants in a lawsuit challenging the legitimacy of Georgia's voting machines. The lawyer sent word to some federal authorities, including the FBI and such. They contacted Kemp's office, and then what you had was another a web-based journal cyber journalist site called Kemp's office, said they were going to publish a story about this leak, and boom. Several hours later, you have the press release dropped accusing Democrats of actually doing the leak. This is what this is pretty much what Judd found is this is your typical white hat hacking incident.
Yeah, where an you effort to probe
for vulnerabilities, and Kemp's campaign slapped a black hat on it.
Okay, all that happened back then. The bottom line, by the way, the Kemp campaign responded to us. We asked them what they think about this news story, which suggests that this was a ploy by the Kemp campaign, by the cooperative Secretary of State's office. And they say, look, this is under investigation by GBI. We're not going to say anything about it right now. I know Alan Judd worked hard on this story. I'm not sure how much new information we got. We're still waiting for more evidence that of what really happened here.
And that's something we're still not sure about yet because it's still a pending investigation. We're not getting too many details from the GBI right now. And what we understand is last we checked too, the state Democratic officials hadn't been even contacted yet. And that might have changed in the last week or so, but that's the last time we checked with them. They hadn't been contacted yet. So there's still a lot of open questions. But remember the timing. This was the Sunday before the election,
yeah,
the eve of Donald Trump's visit. So a lot of things were going on then. And the timing of of it raised a lot of eyebrows.
You know, Scott, one of the things that's interesting to me about this is, of course, throughout the campaign, there were questions as to whether Brian Kemp should step down from his position. Wouldn't it have relieved everyone of this notion that he was operating with a massive conflict of interest? But I wonder about something. Even if he had stepped down, when a story like this broke, is anybody going to suggest that the people who are all there because he put them there aren't perhaps also going to have the same kind of prejudices that that Kemp himself was accused of?
I think that's fair, but I also think that you could build systems and processes to make the public have confidence in the system. That's sort of a different conversation. But on this issue, one, we know, not conspiracy theory things, but actually provably, the Secretary of State's office has had issues going back to at least August of 2016, of vulnerabilities of being poorly run, and even before that with the data breach in 2015. With this issue, when I saw it, I immediately thought it was nonsense. I filed an Open Records Act request. Again, they hid behind the investigation exemption. The one document that they provided was dated the day after they announced the investigation. So I'm going to stay on this. I also think that all of the emails, texts, and messages between the campaign and the government workers should be released to the public.
Loretta? What's your take on all this?
Well, I think to the article specifically, I think it is a full accounting of what happened. I don't, to multiple points raised here, there is no more conclusive evidence than we had going into the story. And I think that we're going to have to wait and see how it plays out, candidly.
I'm sorry. The problem, though, Jim, is this is yet another cloud to sit on top of people's concerns about whether we had a fair and honest election and how the Secretary of State's office dealt with the election.
It's going to affect the debate over the voting machines. It's going to affect every debate over voting procedures in the House Governmental Affairs Committee and its Senate counterpart. One thing I would just offer up is it's very possible that when Democrats take over the U.S. House in January, that this incident could become one of their topics of investigation.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's already been, am I right, Greg, that we've already seen Democrats who will be in positions of control on committees who've suggested they want to bring Brian Kemp to Washington and have him testify.
Exactly. We've already seen an incoming U.S. House Democratic Committee Chair say that they're considering subpoenaing not only Brian Kemp, but also officials in North Dakota and North Carolina, where there are also certain issues.
It's another reason I wonder if it isn't in the best interest of the governor-elect to say, let's tackle some of the concerns that we've been seeing here, kind of turn a page on this, Scott.
I think that would be smart, but a lot of times people don't do smart things in this business.
Okay, well, all right.
Well, it's imperative, really, that this issue be addressed during this legislative session, because if you're looking to 2020, we don't want to have a repeat in 2020, and it will take time to deploy whatever solution is decided upon.
Yeah,
whatever type of machine is decided upon, whatever type of procedures and protocols are put in place for local counties, you know, all of that has to be set. It takes a lot of time to get that work done.
And we have not mentioned the 100,000 or so missing votes from the lieutenant governor's race between Jeff Duncan and Sarah.
Which may have been a function of faulty electronic touchscreen machines, right? Potentially.
Right. But so far, there's been a lack of curiosity into that incident.
All right. We've only got a few minutes left, and I got a lot of ground that I was hoping to cover, some of which we will, some of which I'm afraid we won't get to. Number one, I've been saying for two shows, we talk a little about the Farm Bill, which finally passed. Let's just limit at this conversation and come back to it next week. Sonny Perdue, Loretta, your old boss, did not get what he wanted and what the president seemed to want and what a lot of Republicans wanted, which was a work requirement for SNAP benefits or food stamp benefits. It fell out because there just wasn't enough support for it.
That's right. And it was more imperative to get the Farm Bill through because farmers need to rely upon some of the other provisions, most importantly, predictability. So as they get ready to plant, they need to know what they can expect for the next 5 years.
Blueberry farmers in Georgia are angry. They did not get the subsidies that they had expected to get out of this bill, right?
Yeah, it is wild when you look at the farm bill, how many people who are such strong free market advocates sure do love their subsidies when it comes to the farm bill.
Yeah, and the other thing hidden in that is it will now be legal to grow hemp everywhere in
hemp,
the United
not
States.
Kemp.
Hemp,
not kemp.
Hemp on the mind.
Kemp for hemp. I love that.
Hemp in Georgia.
Which is a huge sea change, right? I
mean, that's a huge sea change, and it could really affect the medicinal marijuana debate in the legislature in January.
Yeah, and we know we're going to see that debate come up again with a proposal for production of cannabinoid oil, if I said that right.
Cannabis.
Okay.
To create cannabinoid oil.
To create cannabinoid oil. All right. Jim Galloway, let's talk for a minute. You recounted this week a story about something that happened when Eric Erickson, the WSB radio talk show host and well-known conservative nationwide, held an event here in 2015 when he brought the Republican candidates for president to Atlanta. Tell us why you brought that story up again in your column and what this is all about.
All right. Late this summer, we had the federal prosecutors in New York brought out their indictment against Michael Cohen, and that had this fascinating little paragraph that says, in August or somewhere around August 2015, you had this meeting between Cohen, the publisher of the National Enquirer, and a certain member of the Trump campaign, meeting to discuss a catch and kill system to dissuade
the women who Trump who alleged that Trump had had affairs
exactly,
with them.
Exactly. Okay. All right. On Wednesday, we found out it was the National Enquirer, and now recent reporting says the guy in the room, other guy in the room, was Donald Trump. All right. So you've got that event. But at the same time that this was happening, the first weekend in August, we had this three-day red state gathering that Erickson put together. And, of course, that was preceded a day earlier by the first CNN debate of Republican presidential candidates. Megyn Kelly asks Donald why he is so rude to women. The next day, Donald Trump says, oh, she was just mad at me, and she had blood coming out of
her whatever.
Whatever, yeah. You know. It was a reference to menstruation. Eric Erickson drew a line in the sand, said, you're not coming to my event. Greg, you were there that weekend. Things just blew up there.
He banned him, Eric. I was there. We all were there, including Loretta. And Eric came out on the stage. He said, I just want you all to know I cannot allow Trump to come after these comments. My daughter can't be exposed to this sort of stuff. She's here. Jeb Bush came out and said, I absolutely agree with what Eric has decided to do.
Most of the 16 or so candidates were actually there, too, and many of them agreed. And I'll never forget, I mean, Eric Erickson actually made the announcement at a hotel bar the night before. And so a few reporters, I was not there, but a few reporters who were having drinks got the scoop that night that Donald Trump was disinvited.
And
major moment.
The point of all this is to say, Jim, you say the month of August of 2015 was a month in which Trump's treatment of women
was
highlighted.
It was not a single event. It didn't happen in a single room. It was a theme of the month.
So as long as we're being nostalgic, Loretta Lepore, that was a huge victory for your candidate. Did Carly Fiorina, why?
Well, she was coming off of her big debate, and she had scored a lot of points with the American public and was very well received here in Georgia and at Red State. And so that's my whole memory of that event, nothing else. But, it was a change moment for her in her campaign.
You told us before the show went on the air that the rooms you needed got bigger and bigger because so many people
they
were
did.
There to
we
see
had
her.
We had a scheduled fundraiser that evening, and so we had to change the room a couple of times to accommodate all the folks that wanted to attend.
All right, I wanted to get that in. I want to get one other quick item in. You were up, we're never far away from another election.
Nope.
We always want to talk about the next election. You were up at an event in North Georgia with John Ossoff. What was that all about?
He had his first town hall meeting in rural Georgia, and he struck a very populist chord there. He talked about the need for antitrust legislation, the corruption in corporate politics, and the need for Democrats to band together and reject corporate money.
With the notion that perhaps this is the beginning of a Senate campaign in which these issues will be what he runs on.
Exactly. I mean, he is not ruled out a bid for U.S. Senate, just like pretty much every other Democratic contender.
Scott, I'm sorry to do this to you with only about 30 seconds, but you're going to start being courted. You may already have been by candidates for the U.S. Senate, Democrats to run against David Perdue. Do you see a clear Democratic challenger? Would you like to see the party get behind one candidate? Will Stacey Abrams run? Teresa Tomlinson told us on our show the other day she's thinking about it. What's going to happen?
Will Scott Holcomb run?
Yeah, Will Scott. Yeah, are you thinking about running?
That's a lot of questions.
And we're out of time. Go ahead. Say one quick thing.
I don't think that there will be one candidate on the Democratic side. I think that it will be a contested field, and I think that a strong candidate will run against Purdue in 2020.
Do you want to be among them?
I'm not even thinking about that right now, and that's...
Always a dangerous sign. Scott Holcomb, Loretta Lepore, Greg Bluestein, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for a great show today. We're out of here for now, but at 2 o'clock on Monday, we'll be right back with you with a new Rewind. Take care.